Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
Happy Midsummer's weekend and welcome to the podcast. Thanks for joining from wherever you are. Don't forget to follow us on Spotify right now and you'll get this podcast every Friday. So what do? We have a selection of the best conversations from the last couple of days to serve as a warm ear hug for you. And I pray, by the way, that the weekend is sunny and full of barbecues, super splits, putting on a jumper when it gets too cold to stay outside. Ah, it's Ireland's summery wonders at their finest. And shortest. On this week's episode, we have a novel to keep you awake at night, we have a tour among the tombstones in Dublin, and how to make a music festival from scratch. So first off, in the podcast, we have the author from one of my favourite novels for some time, a millennial bestseller, Catherine Prasifka. This is How You Remember It. That's the name of the book. And it's a story about a kid growing up with the internet and how it dominates her life, from innocent chatbot to and froing on the big naughty's family PC computer when she's a child, to the all-consuming force that it has on her teenage existence. It is utterly gripping and it's as addictive as the Facebook storms that it evoked, and you'd be terrified to put it through, especially if you're the parent of young children. Now, in our conversation, Catherine talks about how the internet began as a place we went to and kind of we asked things of it and we were in control. But now, she says, we can't escape the net at all, and it shows us things as the active-passive relationship has reversed. You know, it's teaching us things instead of the other way around. And we also learned in the course of our chat that the generation after Gen Z, as we're calling them, they're going to be known as Generation Alpha. And they're coming for us oldies, that's for sure. After the chat with Catherine Prasifka, we have Warren Farrell, who's in studio. He works in the Trinity Access Programme, but it's his part-time job we were talking about. And that's a fascination for it's a fascination for thousands, of course, because he's a tour guide at Glasnevin Cemetery, the National Necropolis, as it's known in his book. I did the tour the other day and I saw the famous graves, but Warren Farrell really opens our eyes to the forgotten small-time heroes of folklore and Dublin tales, including the brilliant story of one woman whose records show that she was buried twice in Glasnevin. So listen out to that conversation to hear more. And we learn that there are now more dead in Glasnevin Cemetery than there are living across the entire capital city of the country. And finally, we had the crack with Craig Hughes. He's a political journalist with the Irish Daily Mail, but as a sideline, he started a music festival from scratch. He's not a megabooks promoter and he's not from landed gentry, but somehow he managed it with passion and that trademark Mayo higher sense of purpose. So Night and Day Festival, it's in its third year, it's going well. He told us all about that, how he set it up, how it's still going, and how he even managed to keep it going while his mum became very unwell, but she survived, thankfully, to enjoy it. And we chatted about his famous scoops in the newspapers, like revealing Leo Varadkar's famous Kylie letter, and the story about the €2 million printer for the doll that didn't fit in the building. Remember that? That is everything in the podcast. Listen through right to the end to be fully restored to knowledge, and then you can go about your business and wait till Monday, because we'll be back on the wireless, same place as ever, RTE Radio 1, 9am till 10 every weekday until death do us part, or at least until somebody's fired. That's everything. We will start the weekend podcast now.
Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.
Catherine Prasifka, she's a young Irish novelist. She's before me here. Welcome to studio, Catherine. I'm going to tell people about This Is How You Remember It. I've already been raving about it this morning, but people are raving about it. The reviews, it moved one critic in the Guardian newspaper to write her review in the first person, which is a very unusual move. And she finishes the review saying, "It is an essential document." It's a novel she's talking about. "I wish it wasn't. I'm so glad it exists." The London Independent reviewer, I think she said it, "This is the first book I've read that beautifully, heartbreakingly evokes what it's like to grow up as a girl on the internet. Spoiler alert, it's panic attacking." And I'll just go to the acknowledgements here, because you say, "For a long time now, I've been thinking about the effect of social media on my life and doing my best to explore it in my work." That's what you've done with this, isn't it?
That's what I've tried to do. Yeah. I mean, I think social media is something that has had a profound effect on my life and the life of my generation. And the book is written, you know, This Is How You Remember It. It's written in recollection. And I think it's only really possible to see the effects through recollection. you know, yes, looking back afterwards. And seeing, right, wait, what actually happened? Because when that first phone is handed to a child, particularly as it was to me, or rather I begged for it. My parents did not willingly hand me the phone. But
as is the case, a lot of parents
yes,
are nodding
along. Please, please, please.
Because you
don't
know.
But you don't know. And particularly, you know, 10 years ago, you know, even before smartphones, you couldn't predict the effect that putting a phone in a child's hand could have had. So yeah, that's why it's written in recollection and called This Is How You Remember It. Because I think as you're living it, you have no idea.
And you're Gen Z, so you're literally born...
I'm a late millennial. I'm the last of the millennials.
Oh, you squeeze in,
yeah,
do you?
Just about on the cusp. And I have older siblings, so that puts me in millennial category. But okay, I'm not cool enough to be Gen Z. I still wear ankle socks. The Gen Zers will be like,
right,
will be like, oh yeah, okay.
I didn't even know that's a thing, but
it's
you're
a thing,
in
it. It's a thing.
This is your, you've already had a best-selling novel as your second novel, which is also about the internet. So this is a theme in your work. Why do you think so much about it, and why do you think so much about the effect it's had on your life, do you think?
Well, when I was writing my first book, I was thinking, I was, what, 22 or 3 starting to write it, and I thought, I'm not going to write the best book of all time, but I'm going to write a book that I can write. And I was kind of, dissatisfied with how I saw social media portrayed, you know, through fiction, on screen. I was thinking, someone's missing something here, and maybe it takes someone of my age to actually communicate what that thing is. And I'm sure someone younger than me is going to come along and be like, well, actually, this is what the internet is. But I'm waiting for them to come along. But I think it's something that I perhaps am uniquely able to talk about, and I felt was worthwhile. Mm. And I also think it's something that has fundamentally changed the way we interact with ourselves, with each other, with reality, you know, particularly for young people. And it felt for me then very important to write about it.
And there are perfect examples of the kid with the phone and the internet not seeing things around them all, totally consumed by this and wondering what their friends are up to, when they're in a nice, beautiful place and with people who love them and so on. Just not being present.
Tunnel vision into the universe of the screen, which I think is something that we've all experienced. Because something that I'm careful to point out as well is that while I think young people are maybe the most prolific users of the internet, and the internet is something that young people perhaps know more about than their parents, we all have large amount of screen time. We're all on our phones constantly, you know, 4, 5, 6 hours a day looking at this one thing.
That's right,
and there are birds in the sky, you know, there's grass on the ground, and we're just
other
oblivious.
Other humans
to talk to in person.
You've described yourself as part of the guinea pig generation. What do you mean by that?
I think, as I said, young people are some of the most prolific users of the internet. We have just a lot of free time, I suppose. And I feel I really did grow up online at a time when there was very little knowledge, very little parental control. You know, in the book, it kind of explores that idea of the parents don't even know the right questions to ask to get the answers that they're looking for. They couldn't even begin to imagine the answers that they might be given were they to know the questions, you know. And I think that is the world that I grew up in, and that generations beneath me are going to grow up in as well. Now there's a little bit more awareness, you know, millennials are starting to have children who are starting to go on the internet and that kind of thing. But I think it's always going to be something that has passed maybe bottom up, and we're always going to be playing catch up. And I think I was the first generation to really experience that.
So the millennials who grew up on the internet, they think they know everything and they'll be able to chat to their kids, but their kids believe that, of course, their parents know nothing.
Yes, yeah.
And you won't know the half of what's happening.
Yeah, particularly with the algorithms online, you know, there are... Like the internet itself used to be a subculture. To be online, you were part of a culture, a community.
Yeah.
And now it's fractured. The monoculture is broken. If you're really into, I don't know, like Estonian rap, you're going to find 10,000 people to talk to
and
about
you can
it
live
online.
In that world,
and you can live entirely in that world sitting in Dublin, which
and
you couldn't have before.
And not know what's going on in
And not know,
Irish
you know,
culture.
What's happening in even mainstream internet culture, you know. And I think it's based on interest, but it's also based on age. So I wrote this article, you know, about communication online, but also name dropping Skibidi Toilet, which I thought was very funny to get that in the Irish Times. But that was something that like blew my mind when I heard about it, because it is this meme that is popular only with the generation alpha, you know, who are 14 years and below.
Okay.
And it's like a head singing in a toilet. It's kind of bizarre stuff. But you look it up on YouTube. You think I'm joking. It's called Skibidi Toilet. You look it up. Thousands of videos, hundreds of millions of views.
It's a phenomenon.
It's a phenomenon. It's a global phenomenon that nobody over the age of 15 knows about.
Good Lord.
Yeah, so people in your house, you're looking at the phone.
I didn't know about that until now.
Yeah, you're looking at your phone, you're looking at the screen, you're thinking, oh, well, sure, we're all on, I don't know, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, all these same apps or whatever it is, but we're engaging with them in very different ways and becoming more and more divided, you know?
Yeah. Did you say they're alpha? Is that what we're...
Generation alpha.
We're starting at the start.
Apparently.
Again.
I didn't coin that.
Okay. Well, we'll have to watch out for that one. But like they've grown up, the YouTube is television for them. There's no television.
Yeah.
The idea that there's television is scheduled and you sit down at a certain time.
Yeah. And totally there are alien. Ad breaks. The form of television has completely changed. But that's the thing when you're talking about the internet, I think. There are so many things that we take for granted as, well, that's just how the world is. You know, that's just how it is. And then you talk to a child and it's not. Like, you know the way, oh, you answer the phone, you do the hand gesture with, you know, your thumb and your little finger. No, kids put their hand against their face.
They don't know what
it's a smartphone.
Yes, okay. They don't know what that is.
Fundamental little things that are changing. Well, we don't like answering the phone.
Don't use the phone as a phone.
No. Why would you?
Come here to me. The novel starts with the child and there's the unboxing of the big computer. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's a lovely, evocative stretch of innocence at the very start. So you're down at the beach as a family, go to the beach and so on. So it begins with the kind of the unboxing of this giant computer in the mm-hmm. house and the innocent dabbling of the internet. We all start screaming when suddenly the search engine starts suggesting, filling in the words. Explain to us what's going on there in the poor child.
Well, there's a lot, I think, because for me, what I was thinking about my own internet experience was that the internet used to be a place. It used to be something that you sat down at and you could then leave. And then when I was thinking about the desktop computer and that being set up in one part of the house, normally in, you know, a communal room, people are coming and going. Completely different to the idea of having a smartphone, you know, or an iPad or something like that. It's very much anchored. So there's that. And I also kind of wanted to get across the idea that I think the internet has fundamentally changed as well. It used to be something that you dictated. You would say, you know, show me pictures of a unicorn. You would say, I want to go on a Harry Potter fan site. You would search, you know, mini clip games or something. And it would maybe correct your spelling on it, but it would show you what you were looking for. Mm. Now the internet tells you what you should be doing, you know, through algorithms.
That's a really good observation.
I no longer think, oh, maybe I'm going to get into crochet. My TikTok feed just says, hey, do you think you should do some crochet? Do you know? We've kind of ceded agency to some degree. And I think...
And they use a lovely word, suggestion.
Yeah.
So we're just suggesting these things.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, I think in the age of surveillance capitalism, Shoshana Zuboff calls it behavioral certainty. The idea that they know so much about you on a microscopic level that if they nudge you, you jump. Mm. And that's something they can sell to advertisers, which I think is not very good.
The Orwellian view of the world was that the government would put a camera in your room and watch you forcefully. Little did Orwell know, we would volunteer.
And we love the camera, you know, we do
everywhere.
Dances in front of it.
Nobody forced the camera on, and we just decided to do it ourselves.
But I thought it was very important to trace that evolution of technology, right? Mm. That movement from place and from discovery with its own, you know, pitfalls and perils as well that definitely exist there. But trace that into that kind of slow seeding of agency until you no longer really see the screen.
Yeah.
It becomes reality. You know, I think the internet is a technology almost in the way that the written word is a technology, which it was at the time when people started writing things down. It was huge. It changed absolutely everything. But people ask me now, like, oh, how's your relationship with the internet? And I think you should be treating that question like, how's your relationship with text? You know, it's so ubiquitous. It's everywhere. It's changed everything to the point of becoming invisible to us.
Right. It's air.
It's just, it's just fundamental fabric of the universe now, somehow.
We can't move without it. It can't be switched off.
And even if you were to switch it off, the internet is so pervasive in society. Sure, like, you're recording me right now for posting on social media, you know. So it's there. But at any point in time, someone can take out a recording device, take a video of you, put it on Instagram. You could go viral and you at no point have been online.
It's brilliant. It's beautiful. It brings geniuses to the world. It has created geniuses and allowed geniuses to flourish, I suppose. And there's wonderful things about it. And we wouldn't know a lot of news if it wasn't for the internet. But the teenager, because we grow up with this character in the story, she is there at the burgeoning beginning of social media. Take us from there.
I was thinking a lot about, you know, being a teenager is hard, first of all. But I think being a teenager online is maybe a little bit harder, and that there are some experiences that only exist online but have fundamental offline effects as well, or that maybe there are certain ways that the online world amplifies in-person experiences as to change them entirely, you know. Online, there's so much you can read into. Whether or not someone accepts your Facebook friend request was like a big one. How long someone takes to reply, you know, how many messages they send you. All of this is fair game for interpretation online that makes, you know, being a teenager and communicating with your friends terrible. There's a scene in it where her friend has left her Facebook logged in and she's able to read messages sent between her friend and another girl.
That's right. Devastating.
And that's
right.
Devastating messages. That can't exist without the internet, you know. I mean, maybe you could hear gossip or something like that. But, you know, all of these types of things that just really crystallize your experience as a teenager, I really want to showcase that, because I think there's this idea when I was growing up that, you know, you can just turn off your phone or just don't pay attention to it. It's just the internet. Mm. But I wanted to kind of showcase, well, no, it's life. It's no different to offline. And in fact, in some ways can be worse, you know, and that's what I wanted to put in the book.
Did it make the teenage experience any different? Because a lot of the things that happened, were they just transferred from the real world onto Facebook? Did it make things worse? What's your view when you look back at it now? Because
I think it's hard to know. I think maybe in 100 years, someone will have an answer for you, do you know?
Because it was always shunning and bullying and all of those things without the internet, without social media.
Yeah, I think in some ways it just maybe amplified them. But then on a deeper level, I think there were fundamental changes. So,
and
what
a record
I was,
of it.
Yes. And what I was looking at is, say, each technology that I used, you know, during my life has primed me for the next technology that I'm going to use, to the point where it feels nearly just natural. Like, you know, going from one lily pad to the next as a frog, slowly going to be hit by a truck. I don't know why I went for the Frogger reference there,
yeah,
but that's a niche internet joke.
It is.
But just you're slowly, you know, you're the frog in the boiling water or whatever it is, and it just kind of makes sense. But I was looking at the kind of the learned behaviors. So when you go to the internet for answers, you know, when did Napoleon die? You know, how did Vikings bury their dead or whatever it is? The internet throws up a factual answer. But I was kind of thinking, there's so many forums online of people asking these questions that the internet doesn't know. You know, why won't he text me back? Is my friend mad at me? What is this mole? Do you know, those kind of things. And we're looking for concrete answers, and we're kind of primed to believe that we're going to be interpreting fact. And I think when you're a teenager, you are just understanding the world. You have so many questions. You ask the internet responds, but what is the internet telling you to be? Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of what the book is.
I love that line. It says, you know there are things the internet cannot answer, but that doesn't stop you from trying. The sum total of the human experience is distilled into the questions you ask Google in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
That is so true. And the big difference, we're talking about what's the difference between pre-internet and afterwards, is of course the algorithms have, it's become a new tool for all the bad things, and it's become very profitable for companies that have become very quickly more powerful than whole countries, whole continents. And that's where the problem is, because they double down.
Yeah.
And there is no escape.
And they have no financial incentive to like relinquish our attention.
No.
And we all know that negative engagement fuels more engagement than positive engagement. You see a cute picture of a dog, someone says cute dog, conversation ends.
Yeah.
You see a photo, someone leaves a hate comment, then there's the backlash to the hate comment and the backlash to the backlash.
And that's
the backlash
amplified.
That gets amplified.
That gets the data.
That gets the attention.
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking, okay, we're living somehow in a reality whereby that is what is most profitable. And young people being the most prolific users, somehow we've created an economy that is based off of making teenagers anxious.
Mm.
And I think something that I always want to say on this is that, again, I grew up with this narrative of like, just get off your phone, or, you know, seeing the, you know, addicted to social media young girl, and isn't she vapid and whatever. But this isn't a world that I ever consented to live in. This isn't one that I've ever had any agency over. You know, I haven't created these apps. I'm making no money from these things. It's the generation above me and above that that is always
making the money.
If you're not
honest, you're actually not in the community of your
You're not in the community.
Peers.
And there are very good things about the internet. But I think we're moving more into this kind of profit-driven, scary sphere, as opposed to, you know, the community based kind of grassroots, sometimes anonymous sphere that the internet used to be, maybe in like the 2000s, you know.
What's really interesting is that, and you mentioned it at the end in your acknowledgements, of how you kind of created the storyline for this character, which is all in the second person. So mm-hmm. you really want the reader to feel like that we were a girl. Are a girl who grew up on the internet.
Yes.
It's from a collection of your friends and people you know that you,
yeah,
you sat down and
things
chatted.
That I was aware of and things like that. But the book kind of started from just questions I was asking my friends of, well, did you ever experience anything online, perhaps when you were too young, that fundamentally shaped who you were, that you can't get out of your head now? And nearly every single person said,
really,
yes, I have this story, I have this. And it just got me thinking about, I suppose, the capacity for harm on the online and what that does to your sense of self. And I think I've had some funny reactions to the book, in that everyone kind of my generation and younger has said, this is so true, get out of my brain, I do remember it, oh my God. And everyone older than me is like, I'm terrified. Please tell me this is not what it's like. And, you know, I suppose the title is a bit accusatory. And in the beginning, it opens with, you do remember it, don't you? Why don't you? Because we all do. And if you don't remember it, but yet you facilitated a world where we were forced to live it.
This is
how you remember it. This is what it was like.
There's a bit of hope there towards the end, to be fair.
Yeah, people ask me, would you not be nice about the internet, you know? And I love my phone. I love having my phone 6 inches from my face, scrolling, dog video, meme. I love it, you know? And I have a lot of friends that I keep in touch with only online. There's a lot of very, very good things. But I think it's maybe about intention and about how can we get our agency back from the internet? How can we be, you know, more mindful of what we are doing and what we are sharing? And I think that comes from deconstructing how the internet has changed things for us, you know, how it kind of reduces everything to clickable, shareable content, including the most fundamental elements of the human experience and human connection and all those kind of things. So I feel negative, but I'm hopeful that we can maybe start moving in a better direction.
Yeah. And there's sometimes people will accuse you of hypocrisy if you criticize Facebook or so and so on. And then you're on it. You're on Instagram. But of course, there is a contract there, isn't there? As the famous, you said, the product is free, then you're the price, basically.
Yeah.
And there's a contract that they're supposed to use our data well and so on. It's an unbelievable story. I think parents of small children are going to be worried, as you've kind of pointed out. Parents of teenagers are probably going to say, oh yeah, this feels familiar. This was like living with them. And I think parents themselves will probably recognise themselves towards the end, is what I hope. And there's a great part in it where the mum is trying to have a chat with the teenage girl. And I said, well, the mum's not going to understand anything. She doesn't even know how to copy and paste. What is she talking about?
That's, sorry, mum. I know she's listening. But that's the one thing that I always have to help her do, copy and paste into emails. But I think that kind of feeds into kind of what I've been saying of, I think there is a complete generational divide. But, you know, my mother never knew, you know, the questions to ask me. And sure, if you've ever received a PDF from my father, no, you haven't. That was me. I had to convert that to the PDF. So that technology is there. But I'm not trying to scare anyone, really. Mm-hmm. But what I wanted to do was accurately depict the truth, or how I saw it, or how my friends kind of see it, you know. And I think for me, it felt important to write because I think it's such a specific experience of growing up that kind of doesn't really feel real, or felt very difficult to put into fiction, because we have an idea of how novels function and how stories and novels function, and they follow certain paths, and they're kind of, it's kind of difficult to get social media in there because it's such a change to the usual kind of growing up narrative. And I wanted to just have a go, I suppose, at kind of forcing that change into the novel. And I always write with a idea of communicating something.
You have a motivation behind it, and I hope it's not lost in our conversation that there is a fantastic plot. And I didn't think a man in my 40s, I'd be going, is she going to talk to Lorcan again?
Yeah.
what's going on with Fiona? I don't know what's happening in these guys. It was like kind of like a roller coaster Netflix series aimed at millennials, but for the older bunch of us, we're getting this insight into the older mind, maybe.
Yeah.
This is how you remember. That's what's called Catherine Prasifka. It's been an absolute pleasure. The best of luck with it. Well, you're getting rave reviews already, so you'll be fine. The publisher is Canongate.
Yes.
Canongate. Good luck with it. We'll chat to you again, and I hope the campaign works. But at least we're entertained along the way.
Thank you.
Good luck, and thanks a million. 51551 is the text.
This is the Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1 podcast. Callan on RTE Radio 1.
Now, you're all very welcome back. Now, if you take a tour of Glasnevin Cemetery in Dublin, you'll see the resting places of some of our starriest names in history. Michael Collins, of course, the most visited grave there. Charles Stewart Parnell, Brendan Behan, they're all in there. But there's a new book by a tour guide at Glasnevin, and it focuses on the less well-knowns. Warren Farrell, welcome to studio.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
Actually, why is it called So Once Was I, the name of the book?
It's a good question. So if you're in the cemetery and you're walking around, like, a lot of headstones have different epitaphs, as you seen yourself yesterday, Oliver, when you were up there.
Thank you for the tour.
No problem at all. It meant the last 1 hour, so it was an Irish 60-minute tour at the end we got. But in terms of the title of the book, it's from an old epitaph. So Once Was I is a reminder of we're all immortal, we're all going to be there one day, we're going to be in the ground. How are we going to be remembered or forgotten about? So the line is, remember now as you go by, as you are now, so once was I.
So once was I.
It's kind of just a reminder to everyone, we're all going to end up, maybe it mightn't be Glasnevin, it could be somewhere else, but we'll be remembered with a big round tower like Daniel O'Connell, will we have an unmarked grave? So it's just a reminder that it'd be nice to have our stories remembered one day as well, yeah.
It is, yeah. It's because we were even talking the other day, because I was at a wake at the weekend, and how we praise ourselves for doing death so well in Ireland, don't we?
We do death well. We do.
Do we love graveyards more? But you've met international
people. I think it's a combination of, like, you know, storytelling. So we love a good story.
That's right. Yeah.
And then we do love a good wake. Well, I'm from Dublin, so wake is not as maybe familiar to me as a local Dub.
Is that right?
I've never been to a wake before, I have to say.
They're usually in funeral homes now, aren't
they? Yeah, usually funeral places like maybe Massey's and stuff like that, or Fannigan's. They have their own kind of funeral parlours. Yeah. But I think the combination of storytelling and how we remember someone, and having the wake and telling the stories about someone as well, taking the light with the dark, I think we're quite good at that. So places like Glasnevin have that fascination for Irish people. But it does have an international kind of intrigue as well, because there is, like, it's kind of cliche to say, but there is kind of a story for everybody in Glasnevin.
But there is. I mean, that's what life is, isn't it? And that's why we have headstones to mark people who passed, or tiles in terms of the cremations, which are now more and more popular. But walking around yesterday, the celebrities' graves are the draw. Mm. But when I was chatting to you, you find yourself wandering over to random graves and
it was hard to keep you on track yesterday, Oliver. You kept kind of going off like, oh, look at this one.
And that's what your book is so beautiful, because it is remembering the lesser known people. That's such a good idea.
And like the book itself, like when I first started writing the book in 2020, so it's taken 4 years to get to this stage.
Right.
But it wasn't envisaged as a book from the start. It was kind of a way of me writing down all these stories I'd learned over time. So I've been in the cemetery 8 years, full-time, part-time, everything in between. And just so many people telling stories, whether it's having a pint outside the Gravedigger's Pub or John Kavanagh's, whether it's tour guides past and present. But they're all oral stories in many respects, and none of them have ever been physically written down before.
Right.
So I just thought it'd be a nice exercise for me personally to do, firstly, start jotting down all these stories. And then over time, they started to form quite a lengthy kind of draft text.
Yeah.
The 150 people, it was about 300,000 words. There was a lot in there.
There are so many
poor old Mary and Press out there were cut out then.
We're even going to be forgetting people this morning.
Yeah,
if you get the book, you get the whole lot.
It's impossible to get everyone.
And you spoke to lots of tour guides present and some retired ones as well.
Yeah.
Which is what a lot of stories. I love that's how some of the stories came about.
That's where a lot of the stories would have come from now. Yeah. So I'm not like the great oracle. I haven't discovered all of these stories, so I'm not claiming to be that person, but I'd like to have them recorded somewhere, so that's the purpose of the book.
It's really an old place, Glasnevin Cemetery, and it's not a graveyard.
No, it's a cemetery, yes. So there's a little bit of a difference. So I suppose if we're going back to Glasnevin when it was set up in 1832 by Daniel O'Connell, the great liberator, the emancipator, and he sets up Glasnevin really to be different to that of a local graveyard or a churchyard.
Yeah.
I mean, at the time, you had penal laws, penal restrictions, going back to the 18th century in Ireland. The Reformation had placed harsh restrictions on the Catholics, and how you buried your dead became very, you know, contentious. Restricted burial rites, funeral services, paying really high prices for the right to be buried in what became established church land. So that was Church of Ireland, you know, at the time. So for Daniel O'Connell, when he sets up Glasnevin, he doesn't want it to be an unorganised local parish churchyard. It's meant to be an organised, planned space.
Right.
Records are kept, amassed. Headstones tell you the story. And it's a garden cemetery. So it's very much based on what you might see in, like, Père Lachaise in Paris.
Yeah.
That was the prototype garden cemetery. And I know we joked yesterday about Napoleon Bonaparte. He actually decreed in 1804 that all local churchyards were to cease burials in France. Mm-hmm. And they were to move towards the cemetery plan. So that's where he set up Père Lachaise.
And the great legacy.
Yeah, the great legacy. You don't immediately
forget the battles.
To.
It's
yeah,
the bureaucracy.
Forget Waterloo. It's all about cemeteries. But from those ideals on the continent, they eventually reach Ireland. And so you get places like Glasnevin set up. You get Mount Jerome on the other side of the city set up in 1836. And both cemeteries, Mount Jerome and Glasnevin, despite local kind of Dublin beliefs, they're both non-denominational from the start.
Brilliant,
however, like local Dubliners would probably have maintained that, yes, Glasnevin is non-denominational, but it's kind of for the Catholics of Dublin.
Yeah.
Whereas Mount Jerome, yes, it's non-denominational, but more for the Protestant population.
Traditionally.
Of Dublin. Traditionally,
rather than
yeah.
actually officially.
But that
it?
Doesn't diminish the fact that there is people of all different faiths.
Yeah.
Kind of just scattered around the grounds in Glasnevin. Mm.
And you have some of your own people there, don't you? You
have yeah, I have loads of family up there. So
family in Glasnevin.
There is.
We've got to say the graveyard is attached when it's attached to a parish or a church, isn't it? And the cemetery is
yes.
when it's actually purpose
yeah.
built. But you have a good few relatives.
I do. So we have mainly the Farrell side of my family and my grandmother's side. Mm. One of her relations, she kindly gave me permission to write about her in the book. Her name is Mary Lacken, and she was a fish dealer basically in the inner city of Dublin. And in 1896, if you go to the Irish Times archives, you'll see boy killed by his mother. And basically, her young son, Patrick, just 16 at the time, he was moaning about the way she'd cooked his eggs for breakfast. And so she kind of picked up a pair of fish dealing scissors that she'd cut the fishes with, and she threw them out of anger. But he ended up killing poor old Patrick, just 16 years old. And so she goes to Green Street Courthouse. There's a big case. It's all documented in the Irish Times.
Yeah.
She goes to the Grange Gorman for 2 years, and she dies in 1900 destitute in the North Dublin Union. The husband ended up in the same way, and Patrick, the son that died 16 years of age, he's buried in an unmarked grave quite close to the gravediggers at the John Kavanagh's entrance to the cemetery.
Because there's a poor plot there, wasn't
there? There is. So there would have been where unpurchased graves. So you had the right to be buried in the cemetery.
Is that right?
But you might necessarily have the money to pay to own a grave, which would have been quite common at the time.
So they're unmarked, are they?
Yeah. So like Glasnevin is the final resting place of about 1.5 million people.
Yeah.
So the majority of those are more like the stories in my book or my own great-great-great-grandmother. They're in unmarked plots. So 1.5 million people, only 200,000.
1.5 million?
Yeah, 1.5. So there's actually more people in the cemetery dead than there are alive outside in Dublin City, as of the last census data in 2022.
That's right, yeah.
But yeah, like it's a really hard place to kind of track down every story. There's only about 200,000 monuments. When I say only, that's still a lot of monuments, but for the 1.5 million.
We better get into the stories.
Yeah, we better get into the stories, yeah.
Because tell me about Maria Higgins. I mentioned at the start there was somebody who had a unique record. Go on.
Yeah, so Maria's an interesting one. Maria's the only person buried in the cemetery with two separate burial entries.
Mm-hmm.
So she has two graves, essentially. So go back to the start of her story. The start of the end, really, where she died. She died, apparently, in late July of 1858. Mm-hmm. And the funeral comes up to the original arched entrance of Glasnevin. Comes in with the horses with the black plumes and the hearse. And
lovely, yeah.
They come in on the 31st of July, 1858. And Charles, the husband, is there. His brother, John, and the brother-in-law. And she's lowered into the grave. And they think that's it, you know, another normal funeral, job done. But then 2 years later, a supposed Maria Higgins shows up on Nassau Street in a solicitor's office, and she's not best pleased that she's complaining about her final will and testament. It turns out Maria had faked her own death to get her hands on £500, was left her in a family will, so that the will stipulated that she'd only get the money after her death for her children's well-being, and in the absence of children, it'd go to the beneficiary of her will. So,
Of her own will, yes.
So she thought, look, we'll fake my death. The husband and stuff can be the beneficiary in the will, and we'll get all the cash, and we'll have a happy second life. But what transpired was, in the newspapers, there was a massive case.
I'd imagine.
The fraudulent burial case. It went to Green Street Courthouse as well.
International attention.
International attention across the UK. But Maria Higgins actually found out that the husband and her own brother-in-law, John, they'd actually changed the will, which had the effect of cutting her out of the picture.
Mm-hmm.
So they probably thought, like, once she's supposedly dead, she's not going to come back to claim that this has been a mistake.
Yeah,
how wrong could they have been? she's there. And long story short, 13 years later, she dies for real, 24th of July, 1871, is laid to rest in a separate plot, which is unmarked today. John, the brother, He went off with all the money, supposedly.
Is that right?
Charles, the husband, got 2 years imprisonment, along with her brother, William.
And along with nothing.
And the doctor that had signed the death cert to sign off on this whole thing, he died before it ever went to trial. Mm-hmm. He died of liver failure. Apparently he was quite fond of Paris whiskey, so...
And that was his payment.
That was his payment for signing the death cert. Yeah, exactly. So, lived once, buried twice. It would be a good line to sum up Maria's
story. Maria Higgins has two... She's the only person who has two...
Only person with two burial records, though she died once.
She got off, by the way.
Was found innocent. She kind of argued that she was coerced to go along with the whole plan.
And sexism worked out in her favour. Yeah, a woman couldn't possibly do a fraud.
No, possibly not. No. But there was even someone in the court case aptly called Catherine Codd, who was summoned to give evidence. And there's a whole cast of characters in the newspapers. But it's very interesting to read through in Irish newspaper archives. If you have a little subscription on that, you can go through them all. And it's really interesting.
Oh, I bet you do. Tell us about the most bitten man in show business.
Yeah, the most bitten man in show... Interesting segue. But Bill Stevens. So Bill Stevens was an ill-fated lion tamer. Mm-hmm. And he basically made his living. He had three lions. One lioness, two lions. But on the 11th of November 1951, if you had been coming out of the cinema on Fairview Strand... I think it's a Tesco Express today. But people came out, they're going to see this movie called Jungle Capers, and they come out onto the street and there is an actual lion on Fairview Strand. The link of the lion had escaped from its enclosure where Bill was keeping them safe in the off-season. He worked for Fawcett Circus. Essentially, Bill tried to recapture the lion. In the end, the guards had to shoot the poor old animal, and he wanted to then add a new kind of terrifying element to his act. So he persuaded Dublin Zoo to sell him a lion, which was called Prince Albert. Mm-hmm. He renamed the lion Pasha because he thought that was more exotic, I suppose.
Yeah, he was right.
And his wife May was part of the act as well. And she was seen as quite exotic from the East. You know, that's what she was branded as. She wasn't actually that exotic. She was from the East Wall in Dublin, which is as exotic as it kind of got. But it was a captivating performance. Like, he put his head inside the lion's mouth. He'd feed the lion with his own teeth. And May would lie down. The lions would jump back and forth over her. But this particular lion, Pasha, had a bit of a bad rep. It had apparently killed before in Antwerp Zoo.
Lovely.
So naturally, he thought that was a perfect fit for the act. But in 1953, of January of that year, he was trying to impress a talent scout from the Ringling Brothers Circus in the United States.
Which he was mad to get to.
Mad to get to the States to make it big as a big lion tamer. So he puts on a new suit. He goes into the enclosure. The lion Pasha probably didn't recognise the scent of the new suit.
The new clothes. Oh,
yeah.
God.
That's what the Fawcett Circus would maintain was the basis of this. And when he goes into the enclosure, he suffers horrific injuries. The poor old Pasha, poor old Bill, he gets mauled to death by this lion Pasha. He's only 29 years old, but he packed a lot into his 29 years. And he's one of the more unusual causes of death in the cemetery, mauled to death by a lion. There is other ones.
It's on
the death cert.
Oh, it is. Oh, it's on the death cert. Mauled.
And on his headstone, there's a little shield that says lion tamer. But it doesn't give us cause of death, which I think is nice.
You can kind of guess. Yeah. Maggie from Mayo, this was a phenomenal woman, and she has a very prominent grave, actually, in Last Heaven as a result.
Maggie's another interesting one. So we've gone from animals and kind of captivating performances to another type of performance, which she was an operatic singer. Her name was La Margarita Sheridan, or La Prima Donna. And in April of 1958, she passed away. When she passed away, the night that she died, the 17th of April of that year, there was a performance in the Gaiety Theatre. Eamon de Valera, as president, was in the presidential box. Yeah. And the Italian ambassador cut off the performance to take to the stage and announce that La Margarita had passed away, the great prima donna.
Right.
Puccini, Toscanini, they all rated her very highly. Covent Garden, La Scala in Milan. From 1918 to 1930, she was
phenomenal.
The Madame of Butterfly, you know, La Boheme.
Puccini himself coaches her for
yeah, Madame even Puccini coaches her. Marconi, the great inventor, he met her a couple of times and he convinced her to go to Italy. So she had friends in high places.
We have a clip of her, this Madame Butterfly, from 1929.
Thank you.
Margaret Burke Sheridan, and she's very close to De Valera, isn't she?
Very close. She's buried next to her best friend, Kathleen O'Connell, who was the secretary to Dev. So she made arrangements with Cyril Cusack, the actor. She said, I'm happy that I'll be tippy-toes with Kathleen and Glass Nevins. So so she was 69 when she died. Yeah.
We don't have Bram Stoker in Glass, he's buried in London somewhere, but we have Frank Stoker, who's a cousin.
Yeah, Frank, he's a distant cousin. Yeah, Frank, very different to the distant cousin Bram. Mm-hmm. He was a dentist by profession, Frank. But his
claim to fame is he's the only...
He's the only person to ever be capped by an Irish any international rugby squad and to actually win Wimbledon. So as we come into tennis season, I suppose, good to mention him. Yeah. He won Wimbledon as a doubles partner with his partner from Killiney, Joshua Pimms, 1890 and 1893, the golden age of tennis. We've never quite regained those heights again.
The woman, she's a remarkable name, an unbelievable story. Mary O'Kelly de Galway. That's a good one to end on.
Yeah, this probably has the makings of a drama or some type of film production. But Mary Cummins was her maiden name, born in 1905 in Dublin. Born into a large family, she goes to the Dominican College on Eccles Street and she excels in languages. So she goes to Belgium and she becomes a governess. And while she's over there, the Second World War breaks out. So she decides she's going to join the Belgian resistance. And as far as I'm aware, she's the only person from Ireland to ever join the Belgian resistance.
Yes, I'd imagine.
She's doing dispatches, collecting weapons, smuggling things, very dangerous stuff. And then she's arrested by the Gestapo and she's sent to a range of awful camps from Dresden to Bremen, Essen, Bergen-Belsen. And then she's scheduled for extermination in Auschwitz. So she's on this train going to Auschwitz, contemplating the last few hours of her life. And then it turns out that the train had derailed. So luckily, the train is sent back to Bergen-Belsen.
Yeah.
And she's there for the liberation of the camp and she survives. But at the time of liberation, she was only 5 stone. She had calcification of the spine. There was a radio documentary done by RTE in 1993. Mm-hmm. And she kind of lived through some of her experience.
20 seconds. We have 20 seconds over here.
So they informed me about all this resistance. They told me it was very, very dangerous. And then they said to me, have you got an English passport or an Irish passport? And I said I had an Irish passport. Oh, they say, ça c'est bien, that's very good. You know, c'est très bien ça. And because they won't suspect you. You'll be wonderful for the resistance because they won't suspect you, you see.
She's a gorgeous voice. That's on Radio 1, RTÉ Doc, In the Shadow of Death. She lives into her 90s, that woman,
after
that story.
Yeah, she lives until 1999. And that's where her surname comes from. She married a man called Count Guy O'Kelly de Galway. But he disappeared 15 years after they married, without a trace. We don't really know who the real guy was, but she survives Auschwitz, survives World War II, then loses the husband, but lives till 94, is cremated in glass.
Has a lovely life walking around.
It's a beautiful life. She has a very positive outlook for someone that went through so much.
She's on one of
the cremation walls, which is very hard to find. Yeah. But again, that's one of the main points of the book.
We have to go, Warren, but there's loads of praise coming in for you. I'm currently reading this book. It's great. Warren brings the stories of these people back to life in such a relatable way, it says Paul. And someone's praising, he says, we did the grave robber tour of Warren at Halloween. It was brilliant, so entertaining for young and old. He's funny, great with the kids, brilliant stories to tell. Best of luck with the book, says Stephanie. And the book is So Once Was I, as he explained at the beginning. Warren Farrell, thanks a million.
Thanks very much, Oliver.
Good luck. Good morning to you.
Cheers.
This is the Oliver Callan on RTÉ Radio 1 podcast. Oliver Callan on RTÉ Radio 1.
51551. That is the text before me is Craig Hughes. He's the political editor of the Irish Daily Mail. He's also founder of Night and Day Festival. Welcome, Craig.
Good morning, Oliver.
Mayo man putting on a festival in Roscommon, works for a Dublin newspaper. Very complicated. So how does this happen? How do you become the creator of a music festival when you've got a very busy job?
Yeah, well, fortunately, I have a good team around me and a lot of crazy, lunatic family members to help pull it off. I guess it started with my uncle Brendan, trained as a sound engineer in Liverpool in Paul McCartney School of Performing Arts, and he was kind of working in that field for a bit, and he was working as a production manager for the World Economic Forum, moved back to the west of Ireland and put on a small folk festival in Clamaris, Clamaris Folk Festival. And I was kind of helping out with that, and he said, look, we could do something bigger together. Mm-hmm. And so we set on that route, and there was a tailor-made grant for a new festival in Ireland's Hidden Heartlands, and we were kind of thinking, oh, perfect, this is just what we need.
Hidden Heartlands, the tourism.
Yeah, in that region of the country. We said, perfect, it looks like it's tailor-made for us. And then, of course, pandemic happened, it got pulled, and we were left going, oh God, what do we do? So we kind of ploughed ahead anyway, and somehow gathered the money together, booked the acts, and as soon as the pandemic ended, went ahead with it. First of all, in Clonanagh's house in Castlereagh, and then we've since moved to Lochie Forest Park, which is an amazing place to be.
So you were there last year as well?
Yeah, last year.
So this will be the third outing.
There's the third night and day coming up, yes.
But Brendan, you mentioned the World Economic Forum. Yeah. That's the crowd that puts on Davos, is it?
Yeah, so he was working there, so putting on events for those guys.
So was he organising the event, or was he?
He's one of the organisers of part really? Of the events there, yeah.
This
so
extraordinary.
You'll have all the conspiracy theorists now coming in. Globalists!
And the Bilderberg group. Yeah. Oh, so it's a globalist.
Yeah, of course.
It's supposed to be an indie festival. Yeah. Loads of music in the family.
Yeah, I mean, we all played in bands of extremely varying quality throughout the years. Thankfully, none of us will be taken to the night and day stage this year. But no, music has always been a real kind of central team for the family. When Brendan went away travelling with his now wife, I inherited his music collection. So he was training me from a young age. And I think you remember when he brought me along to a Radiohead concert when he came back, and I tried to pay him for the ticket, and he said it's an education. So I guess it's been a long time
students
in gestation.
Don't pay, something, is it? That was Malahide Castle 2008,
something like that. Yeah, Beck was supporting as well.
Beck was supporting Radiohead. That's phenomenal. Yeah. To go as a kid, you were sort of like, even though you would have been, you know, Radiohead would look like Outfits. Did they play Creep? The way it added at that stage. So putting on a thing like this, you mentioned you got the grant as well. You have to bring sponsors on board.
Yeah, we didn't get the grant first time around. I mean, we're very lucky that in the absence of any money, we were kind of left wondering, you know, what do we do? And we eventually ended up, I think Brendan texted Sean Mulryan, who's the owner of Ballymore, the sponsor of Roscommon GAA team and all the rest of it. We've never met him, still haven't. And he came on board as the sponsor for the first 2 years, which was amazing. And then this year, Roscommon County Council and Quealtar are our main sponsors. So really, really great. They've been very active, really, you know, really engaged and really pushing it, which is really, really amazing to see.
We kind of forget that it's the county councils that push a lot of arts all over the country.
Yeah, and I must say they've been really, really excellent, really engaged, and really trying to push it for Roscommon, you know, which is amazing to see.
Yeah, well, Roscommon, I think they're having a big moment. They've got the renovation Strokestown House there, and the Roscommon Arts Centre, which is owned and run by the county council as well. Is a great success, and now you've got this festival going, which they hoped obviously to keep as a fixture. You're going to say something?
I think, you know, obviously the underlying current for this is to one day get Pulp to play at Night and Day and have everyone singing I Want to Live Like Roscommon People.
Yeah, that's the goal, yeah. Well, you know, that's the selling point for them. They'd be very confused for, like, they surely... how can we get anyone to sponsor just to make sure that happens one stage, even if it's remotely done? Putting together a festival, imagine, is a bit of a nightmare.
Yeah, yeah.
Is money the first port of call? You need...
Yeah, well, you have cash flow is obviously an issue as well. So you have, like, your different times you're going to be paying for the big acts. Most of them are going to have to be paid for in advance. So that's why you have festivals put on their ticket sales straight away to kind of have a constant cash flow to pay for things. And I think because it can be a bit of a precarious business, some festivals have gone bust recently. You have a lot of suppliers looking for payment up front, so that kind of creates its own challenges. But yeah, I think overall then you're looking into, like, you know, site management. When people come, like, where do you put them? How many toilets do you need? I mean, we're very blessed actually in Lochie. I guess first of all, you can arrive by boat. I think we're the only festival in the country you can arrive by boat and stay in your boat on cuff sail down the Shannon.
So you go into the Shannon and it goes into Lochie itself.
Into Lochie, yeah. And then it's because it's a purpose-built campsite, you know, everything is there already. Your indoor showers, there's indoor toilets in the campsite. So yeah, very lucky. And it's a real, I guess, kind of luxury experience for camping that you don't get at other festivals.
Because it's nice and small.
Because it's a purpose-built campsite.
Because it's already there, the camping's there. Yeah. And of course, the kids can use the facilities that are there as well, the adventure.
Exactly. We have a fully kind of immersive programme for our under 14. So it's like, whether it's drumming workshops or nature foraging or, you know, things like that, it's really engaging for the kids.
I remember when Oxygen came to an end, the promoters there were saying it was just way too expensive between insurance, security and paying the guards. Because you have to pay, apparently... I suppose for something on that scale, maybe they do. Is that something you've been...
Yeah, but I mean, the fees for that they've been very helpful to us, I must say. And I guess because our numbers are, like, compared to Oxford, which I think would have been like 70,000 or something, we're down around...
Exploded, yeah.
Yeah, we're hoping to have, I think, around 2,500 people there this year. So it's at different scales. So.
But you still have to pay.
Yeah, yeah, you do. If you're having extra guards and stuff, you pay a portion of it.
That's curious, isn't it? Because you just think the guards are, you know, but they're almost for hire. You put on the event, you got the license, these are the responsibilities.
Yes, it all comes with territory.
The acts then obviously are the big thing, so you're nicely supported.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, when we start putting it on, like one of the key focuses has been to like promote Irish music. So every year it's been at least 90% Irish artists, you know.
Oh, go away, right.
Yes, and it's been great to, I guess, have some of the music that we love growing up. So you mentioned Ash, you got Bex One, you know, Damien Dempsey, Mick Flannery, Gemma Hayes. I'm starting to sound like a backbench TD here listening off the towns and the constituency. But No, it's just amazing to have, you know, such amazing artists. And Ireland is blessed with so many amazing artists that you don't really need to go abroad to kind of import talent when you have it all here. And I think as well, that's something that the artists have really bought into as well. They kind of see that, you know, we're music lovers, that we want to curate the lineup that that we love, and not just something that'll sell us a lot of tickets.
The acts, it creates a nice vibe, doesn't it? Because there's a bit of nostalgia going on. A lot of the acts obviously have just continued to write music as well. Mm. We played Ash there this morning. It feels like they were gone for a long time and they've rebooted themselves.
Yeah, they've been back on the festival circuit the last 2 or 3 years, I think, from watching out. And it's one of those bands where I love them growing up, but I never got to see them. So really excited to be bringing them to Lockheed for Night and Day. And then, of course, we've got the emerging acts that are coming through. There's so much exciting Irish music coming through. We're going to have Morgana, which is a really, really exciting new act, you know, like Alvaretti. And we also run a song contest each year for emerging acts to come through, and they win kind of studio recording time and a chance to play at the festival. So yeah, Dark Isle won it this year, so very excited to see those guys.
Dark Isle, are they bands, by the way? Are they
also? Yeah, they're all bands, yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of the unique thing about this as well, because bands were sort of dying away there for a long time because of Ed Sheeran, Adele, Taylor Swift. It's all big individual pop acts around the world, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I guess as well, obviously dance music is we have some electronic music as well, but I guess the cost of having a dance artist is a lot lower than a kind of a big band, because you got so many more people, you got to put them up, you know, all the rest of it. So the costs add up that way. But no, we're committed to it, and it puts such a smile on your face having these bands playing and seeing how happy people are walking around the site, you know.
Dance is absolutely huge again, isn't it?
The
90s is happening.
And you don't remember
the 90s.
But no, I love electronic music, so we do have electronic each act, but I'm in a tug of war with my uncles to bring back an electronic stage, so let's see how that goes.
is the dance in a tent? It has to be really indoors, isn't it?
Yeah, well, our two stages are both inside Big Top Tents, just failed safe against the Irish weather.
Perfect, yeah.
Yeah, although I was looking at the long-term...
It's the west of Ireland, after all.
Indeed, but I was looking at the long-term forecast. The sun is coming, so I've been praying to the old gods and the new, so I'll keep my fingers crossed for that.
We're getting a good Wednesday. I think that's all we can hope for at the minute. How did you do it without big hitters behind you? It's so hard to compete. Congratulations, the festival organisers, is this text. So it's a broad question, really, isn't it? Going in as an indie versus massive players with massive alcohol sponsorship and everything behind them.
I guess starting small is the key to it, not biting off too much too soon. Yeah. So we're kind of trying to grow at scale, but we're always going to be a kind of a small festival. We're not going to be, you know, the next... There's not enough room for another Electric Picnic, you know?
So it's what people want, though, isn't it?
What do you mean?
Well, they don't want to be in huge crowds and it's uncomfortable. They
Speaking for people of a certain age. Yeah, I mean, like, that's... For me, that's like a nightmare. Is going
people in their 40s up.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, I don't want to crush. I was at the Killers the other night, standing there going, oh, this is just nice. Loads of space. And there's no sky overhead. If only I could get a camp chair. But the idea of rocking up on a boat now, that sounds very attractive.
Yes. We'll have you down one of the days, Oliver. on one of your many boats, I'm sure.
Yeah. I don't have any boats to put it together. I'm open to sponsorship. Oh, no, I'm not allowed to do that anymore. Insurance.
Yeah, it's one of the costs in there. Again, I'm sure as we grow bigger, it'll become a bigger cost, but it's been, I guess, manageable so far.
Yeah, that's good news. It's not it's not cancelling things, or it's not a big fear.
Not yet.
It doesn't make you scared. Yeah. If I'm a band and I'm going to this lovely boutique festival, and there's nice buildings around, aren't there? Is there a listed building somewhere around the park? Or
yeah, so it used to be... Oh, I'm going to be getting bad now with my historical knowledge of Lockheed. So there used to be a kind of a big home there. It was burnt down, and then they have a kind of a tower and a visitor centre there, which is used throughout the festival. We repurposed the visitor centre as a green room.
The green room.
Oh, yeah, okay. It does
that's
indeed.
That's where the acts will be hanging out.
Yeah, they'll be hanging out looking over the water. Having a nice beer or whatever else, going over the water, getting nice and calm before they come on stage.
This is part of the attraction for them coming here.
I think so. I think we've made a real effort to kind of look after artists from day one. I mean, I think if you're looking at kind of managing budgets, you'd kind of go, okay, well, what can we cut out on? You say, well, okay, don't feed the artists or anything like that. And we've made a big point of just doing that extra step to, you know, take care of the artists, make sure we've got good equipment. And we hear it back from them. They still talk about it on their own social media when they're not playing at the festival, which has been really, really, really nice to hear.
Brilliant. How family friendly is this festival?
So under 14s attend for free with an adult with a ticket. Otherwise, it's over 20s. It's extremely family friendly. There's the family friendly aspect is really, really curated to keep kids engaged throughout. So whether it's making instruments, whether it's drumming workshops, whether it's foraging for medicinal plants through the forest, it's extremely family friendly. And I think it's probably about a third of our attendees or so will be families.
Can you use buggies around the place?
Yeah, so we're lucky that the ground, because there's access roads around it, it doesn't really tear up like other festival sites. You're not driving big trucks in through it all the way through. So no, it is good, yeah.
Okay, and of course, most of those buggies now have like SUVs, these big wheels. That's why men are happy to push them now. They look kind of masculine. Your own family then, your mum was unwell, I think, during one of them, wasn't it? You had bad news and on top of all the stress of putting the festival, real life comes in.
So in 2014, Mam had a brain tumour taken out. So we had a really devastating time for the family, but she made a full recovery and we were all delighted. And then we announced the festival in November 2021. And then a month later, the week before Christmas, she got a phone call to say that we think the brain tumour is back.
It's back.
And we had all the excitement of just announcing the festival. Yeah. And then we were kind of going, oh, Jesus, you know. But I remember my dad pulling me aside and saying, oh, you know, she's not going to be able to be at the festival because we're looking at, you know, kind of chemo and surgery and all the rest of it. And I remember thinking, yeah, of course not. But that's the last thing in my mind.
Yeah.
But not only was she made a full recovery and at the festival, she insisted on working at it. So the first the first people who arrived were being checked in by Mam, yeah. But it's so it's great, made a full recovery. But I mean, coincidentally today, she's getting her 6-monthly scan. So that's just life now.
That's her life now, yeah.
We're just, yeah.
But that's 10 years after the initial, she's still with us.
So it's great. But I mean, I feel like people ask me, why do you do the festival? Like, why do you put all this stress in your life? But I even think, going back to that first festival, I was flat out running around the place interviewing politicians, just generally, firefighting. Didn't really get to see anyone throughout the festival. And then the Zootons were playing their encore, and I just ended up back at the main stage and ran into my two parents and next thing my brother, and we just got together in a big kind of group hug.
Everyone just arrived
and just singing along. And it's for me, it's one of my favorite moments as a family together, you know. So yeah. I kind of think, you know, If it never happened again, it'd be worth it for moments like that.
That's
perfect.
Yeah, what's your mum's name?
Stella.
Stella. Good luck to you, Stella. Might see you for a bop there. Come here, you're juggling the day job. What things have changed, obviously, in politics over those 10 years of drama. Well, you started in here at one stage, did you?
Yeah, I worked in the investigations unit and I credit RT with knocking the Mayo accent out of me. They sent me for elocution lessons before I...
I always thought this was a myth. There's no... Well, did you actually do elocution?
Yeah. I think it was only about 2 or 3 to make me speak clearly and so people could understand me. But it catches some people off guard. I was in Leinster House one day.
Oh, yeah.
And a politician who shall remain nameless, but let's just say they were recently elected as an MEP for Dublin. We'll call them... A or Reardon. I don't know. Is that too obvious? I'm not sure. But we were talking about the intricacies of the Dáil Bar and the rules around it, the members one.
Oh yeah.
And he said, you know, we just kind of go in there, Craig, to get away from you lot, and I don't know, people from down here on tours from Ballyhaunas. I was like, you know, I'm from Ballyhaunas, and his face just dropped. He said, you're not. And he countered them.
He said, no, you're not from Ballyhaunas.
He said, you're having me on here, and he said, you didn't go to school in Ballyhaunas. As I did. He was completely mortified. I was reveling in his mortification. And he said, oh, look, you'll keep this between ourselves. I said, yeah, of course. But I just thought to myself, you know, but maybe I'll just say it once to Oliver Callan, live on the radio.
Keep it to yourself. He's gone to Brussels. He's gone to Brussels. You have broken some of my favourite stories in recent years. I mean, we'll go with your kind of third best story, which people remember. It's hard to kind of remember the anger at the time now, isn't it, in COVID times. But the was it vaccines? Was it the kind of people jumping the queue?
Yeah, so, and this one, I mean, it was, God, it really took off. It was, I got a phone call late at night from someone in the political world saying, I believe you're the person to talk about, you know, mess ups in the vaccine rollout. I've been writing a lot about bad issues with it. I said, I am. And they had heard that teachers in St. Jude's private school were vaccinated out of turn, right? At the time, you'll recall, it was only people who had been cocooning and people in kind of like, people who would have had cancer and were in active treatment. They were the only ones getting this at the time.
And everybody in the world wanted vaccines because this was the route out.
So I said about going, okay, there has to be a bit more to this, and eventually found out that the CEO of the Beacon Hospital, Michael Cullen, his two kids were in the school.
Oh, yes, I remember this.
He personally called the school to offer them. The story exploded. I think it's seven front pages in a row falling out of that, because then there was people in the creche on the Beacon campus. Then there was issues with utter queue jumping. So it really took off. And it was, people are so angry because they knew someone who really needed a vaccine, whose life would make such a massive difference to, and who weren't getting it. That was that. It was a whirlwind of a time. And actually,
that was a good one.
The night actually we were publishing that story, I was in for kind of a midnight walk along the canal, because that's what you did at the time. And actually, the Taoiseach came walking past me the other way, and Micheál Martin at the time, and we nodded at each other coming past. And I remember just thinking, oh, you'll be busy tomorrow.
They were oblivious at that stage. The story of the printer that
the Dáil printer. Yeah, God, it's working now anyway. But I mean, people will
call it a 2 million euro printer. Was it?
The printer itself cost about 800 grand.
Oh right.
But then, of course, when it landed in Leinster House, it was too big to fit inside the intended room.
Yes,
there was another 200 grand spent on knocking down walls. In the meantime, it was put in storage. So the total cost came to 2 million quid. And so it was ordered in 2018. And eventually,
they refused to use it as well until they got training. Wasn't
yeah.
It?
Yes, and so then eventually it was up and running by 2021. But that came about because I got an anonymous phone call from someone who said, oh, yeah, I really like your stuff. This story about a printer. I said, I don't believe that, you know. Put it in FY, had a big Freedom of Information request, and had a big kind of back and forth battle with them, and they eventually released the information. But I still don't know who the source of that story was, you know.
But you couldn't reveal the source because you don't know who it is.
Yeah.
But it was a whistleblower who steered you in the right direction.
Yeah, yeah.
You must get such a buzz when you... Is it the scoop and it sees on the front page, or is it the reaction? What does it for you?
I remember actually when I came in to... As Sean O'Rourke was presenting at the time, and he came in to talk about that story, and before it went down, he just went, nothing like a good scoop, and that's what it is. It's a great rush from it, you know, great buzz, and like it's
that's the vocational aspect of journalism, and the all time great, the infamous letter signed by Leo Varadkar.
Yeah, then Taoiseach Leo Varadkar went on the Late Late Show, and he was talking about how he went to see Kylie, and there was a bit of controversy at the time, but he'd been accused of getting a free meal or something like that, and so I put in an FOI request looking for all correspondence between him and Kylie. And they came back and they said, oh no, we're refusing your request, but there is one record, but we're refusing it on personal grounds. It was big back and forth. They twice tried to refuse it. And eventually I got it. And it was, dear Kylie. You know,
it was an information commissioner, I think, had to. Was that what happened?
It was due to go to the commissioner, and then they just
relented.
Before that, they were pulling
it. There's nothing better than a letter they don't want you to see.
But the funny thing was, a lot of people were endeared to Leo because of that letter, you know, so I think they're kind of careful.
I don't know, I think you're being very... It was one of the most cringy stories. It kind of set the tone because there was a vacuousness there that hitherto we didn't know. He was very popular at the time. Mm. I mean, we look back at it now and laugh, but it was the Dear Kylie letter. It was excruciating.
I was going to say, I'd love to have Kylie play at the festival, but I wonder if I could get you to voice up a voice note to Kylie sometime to try and...
Of course, anytime. <yeah. laughs> That is great fun. You have such an eclectic bunch of interests, as we said. And we look forward to the next scoop. Craig Hughes, where did you get your anonymous tip-off? No, we can only plug one thing at a time. The Irish Daily Mail, we should credit. That's where you get Craig Hughes' scoops. Night and Day Festival, it is happening at the end of this weekend?
28th to 30th of June. Tickets still available. nightandday.ie/tickets.
nightandday.ie for a nice cosy time with the kids and all involved. And rock up on your boat. I presume you have to pay in, obviously, from your boat.
It's free to moor your boat there. You just need to buy a weekend camping ticket. So
right. It keeps getting better. We'll finish up with one of the acts that's going to be playing on that very weekend. Thank you, Craig Hughes, and good luck to you and your parents. Hello, Stella, one more time. 51551 is the text. There you go. That's it. Don't talk to strangers online. The dead are full of crack, and Roscommon is the centre of all culture. We always give you things to dwell upon of a weekend. It is the end of the podcast as you know it. If you've interesting stories, yarns, and things you think we definitely should know, pop us an email anytime at all. oliver@rte.ie. Happy weekend to everybody. Farewell, slán, agus thanks.